Welcome to Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, a podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. TIPQC exists to improve health outcomes for mothers and infants in Tennessee through our quality collaborative that will identify opportunities to optimize maternal and infant outcomes across our state and is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. The Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast is designed for medical professionals and for patients and families across the state. We will focus on all aspects of the perinatal period with special attention to reducing our maternal mortality rate. This podcast is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health.
Welcome to the Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast, brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. I am Dr. Connie Graves, a maternal field medicine specialist, and I'm the medical director-elect of TIPQC. Today's focus will be on cardiac conditions in pregnancy. We are very grateful to have with us Dr. Karen Florio. Dr. Florio is a board-certified maternal fetal medicine specialist who has an interest and specializes in hypertensive disorders of pregnancy and heart disease. She graduated from New York Institute of Technology, the New York College of Osteopathic Medicine, Brooklyn Methodist Hospital of Cornell, and completed her MFM fellowship at the McGee Women's Hospital at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. She worked for the St. Luke Hospital, University of Missouri, Kansas City Center, where she developed a heart disease and pregnancy program that has now cared for over 2,000 women. At the University of Missouri, she started another cardiac clinic and now serves as the director of OBGYN, as a vice president for patient and safety and quality. She is the lead investigator on the national multi-site HOPE study looking at outcomes for women with heart disease and pregnancy. Dr. Florio is the recent past chair of the Missouri Pregnancy Association Mortality Review Board, as well as the maternal section chair for the Missouri Perinatal Quality Collaborative. Again, we are so honored to have you join us today. As a disclosure, Dr. Florio and I have known each other for a long time, and so this is really a pleasure.
Well, first, I just want to say thank you, Connie. It's always a pleasure, and it's my honor to be here because I've been following your career forever, and you're such an inspiration to me and to other young investigators. So I started my career, I feel like always in medicine, these things happen by accident. You just have to be at the right place at the right time. I really started QI when I joined the St. Luke's team in 2014, and I was the chair of the evidence-based practice committee, so the kind of the QI committee. And through that, I learned to hone some skills on what QI is, how do you develop QI projects, what is the difference between QI and research, and then kind of took those skills and really developed them on a state level, as you do in the Missouri Perinatal Quality Collaborative. You know, when we started the Missouri Perinatal Quality Collaborative in 2018, we had no money. I think there was eight of us, and it was really a grassroots project. And now I'm really happy to say that we have funding from multiple sources, have been able to hire project leads, and are implementing several QI bundles, including the AIM hypertension, SUD, hemorrhage, and now one of the few states that are implementing the cardiac bundle.
And I think that's really interesting. I think a lot of states have had issue or feel like the cardiac bundle is overwhelming. Tell me a little bit about how you approached it from a QI standpoint.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Connie, because I think people get overwhelmed when they look at the AIM bundles, because they think, oh, there's no way at my small hospital or even my large hospital with the limited resources that I have that I would be able to implement any kind of QI project on my own. And I think the important thing to know about QI is that, one, you don't need nearly as many subjects or outcomes as you do with research. There's no such thing as statistical significance in QI. And I think that what people need to understand is that those bundles are not meant to be wholly inclusive, meaning you don't have to implement every single portion of that to be successful or to see change. So you could take pieces of one of the five R's and actually implement one of those pieces. So for instance, on the cardiac bundle, it does seem very overwhelming, because at these smaller institutions in rural areas, they're not going to be able to develop a combined cardiac clinic. And so one of the things that we encourage people to do is just screen people for cardiac disease. That is part of the bundle that would count as a QI implementation. So just developing a way to screen every single one of your patients that comes into your unit for cardiac disease and pregnancy, and that is QI.
I think those are some really great words of wisdom. I know that in our project, our cardiac project, I have been very intentional about involving level one hospitals because I feel like that often they're left out of these bigger projects. What have you done to be intentional in your involvement of your smaller hospitals?
Yeah, so we wanted to make sure, because most of Missouri, as is Tennessee, is rural. And so we intentionally sought out the smaller critical access hospitals, both in the northern part of the state, as well as the southern part of the state, to be included in the bundle. And so our Perinatal Quality Collaborative is very unique in that it is housed within the Missouri Hospital Association. And that comes with a lot of perks, including data abstraction, data analysis, and identifying every single birthing hospital within the state of Missouri. And so what we have done is our lead at the Perinatal Quality Collaborative had reached out to some of these smaller critical access level one, level two hospitals and asked them to participate. We identified a physician champion as well as a nurse champion at each of these institutions and asked them directly if they'd be willing to participate. And so the way that we have them participate is definitely different than the way the more urban centers participate, meaning the urban centers are taking those referrals, they're seeing patients in these cardiac clinics, and those count as the metrics for that hospital. However, we've developed different metrics for improvement and outcomes at the rural hospital. So for instance, as I was saying, screening patients with a validated screening tool would count as a QI metric at a smaller hospital. Or when you identify somebody with cardiac disease at these rural hospitals, getting them to a higher level of care also counts as a metric. So I think it depends on where you're at and what resources you are. But I think the most important thing is that just because you are a smaller hospital in a rural setting does not mean you cannot participate at state level or even regional level quality initiatives.
Thank you so much for that. You helped to start two maternal cardiac clinics. Tell us a little bit more about those and how you got those up and running.
Again, I think everything that we were talking about before, these all things happen by accident, right? They just fall into your lap and you are a product of your circumstances, right? So when I was a fellow, I remember training and having maybe two cardiac patients, right? It wasn't because they weren't there. It was just probably because we weren't screening. And so when I came to Kansas City, you know, our state is very different than Pennsylvania in the sense that we have a larger population of obese patients. And with obesity comes hypertension and cardiac disease, as well as diabetes. And so when I got to Kansas City, I started noticing that there was just a very large burden of patients with cardiac disease. And the clinic really developed out of one patient's experience. And so, as you know, Connie, we are very comfortable with pregnant people. But when you ask sometimes somebody who is in cardiology or family medicine or any other service that doesn't deal with pregnant people as much, it tends to scare them a little bit. And so when you interact with them, what will occur sometimes is they will be reluctant to take these patients on their service. And so that's what happened with this one patient. She got transferred. I can't even remember what cardiac disease she had now, but she got transferred to the cardiac floor. Then she got transferred to the OB floor. Then she got transferred to the ICU. And it was all because nobody could figure out who was the best person to be primary. And so from that experience, we wanted to deliver a better patient-centered experience for these women with heart disease and pregnancy. And so we approached the cardiologists within the division. Now, there was a lot of them. I think there's 66 or 68 of them, but I identified several who would be willing to work with us on these patients with cardiac disease. And so throughout probably about 8 years, we started implementing different structures of care that we thought would help the patient experience, but also outcomes. And so the first thing we did was have our cardiologists come down to our unit where we saw our OB patients and had them see the patient with us in the room. That really streamlined communication, not only between the providers, but also the patient. And we actually did a follow-up study on this, Connie, to see if this was intimidating for patients, if they actually liked this model of care. And it turns out patients really appreciate this model of care. They perceive that the communication between their providers is better, the communication with the providers to the patient is better, and believe it or not, into the inpatient service was better. And so we developed different structures, as I said. One was seeing the patients together or co-locating. Another was dedicating a nurse to be the coordinator or the nurse navigator. That was really helpful in the sense that whenever tests or labs or orders had to be put in or received, there was one person that received all of those, as well as scheduling. Again, streamlining the process for the patient, improving patient satisfaction. Then we identified the availability of the ICU to have a locked unit and room for our patients to deliver it on those very high-risk patients that have, you know, critical aortic stenosis or pulmonary hypertension. Those patients really are unsafe to labor on our labor suite because we didn't have ICU beds down there. And so we would move them up there. And it's important that you have a locked unit, as you know, because babies have to be within a locked unit so that there isn't any chance of one of them being taken off of that floor. So over time, we iteratively added processes that we thought would help care. And in fact, when we looked in 2018 or 17 at our outcomes, we were able to decrease our ICU utilization, improve our gestational age. So it went from 36 to 38 weeks of gestational age on average, increase our birth weights and increase our vaginal delivery rates, as well as decrease our cesarean section rate. So over time, we were able to really improve those outcomes.
I mean, I think that's fascinating. I know that when I first started, we actually did our own OBICU on labor and delivery, which at that time was really novel throughout the country. And you're exactly right. Being able to have a multidisciplinary team is really important. And more importantly, having people who understand cardiac physiology is everything when you talk about these types of things.
Exactly. Exactly. And if we had somebody like you who was critical care and MFM, it would have been super helpful. But, you know, we really relied on the expertise of our ICU docs in that sense. And not only did that help everybody feel comfortable to pregnant patients, we were also learning as providers from each other, which I thought also enhanced care.
Absolutely. I just recently lectured for our ICU just on general, these are the general kind of things, hemodynamic changes you expect in pregnancy. And you'd be amazed at how it makes people much more comfortable in caring for the pregnant patient.
Absolutely. And that's the goal, right? Because none of us are an island. You know, I think that medicine is really moving away from this siloed care towards more multidisciplinary care. And, you know, if you look at different specialties like ortho or oncology does this really well, if you have a multidisciplinary approach, outcomes improve, patient satisfaction improves, and in fact, provider satisfaction improves because we're also learning from other services and it helps us get more comfortable with patients that we didn't necessarily train to take care of.
Oh, absolutely. And more importantly, you know, the multidisciplinary approach, Dr. Davis and I in our first call to action for cardio obstetrics talked about the fact that we have to come out of our silos. We can't afford to just not talk to each other anymore and say, I'm the cardiologist, you know, you're the MFM kind of. And I found in a lot of places, people don't even know what the maternal fetal medicine specialist does. So being right. able to communicate that right across the spectrum is really important.
No, I agree with you. And I think that, you know, if you look at the AIM implementation bundles, they talk about respectful care. And whenever I'm lecturing, I always talk about, yes, respectful care is respectful care to the patient, but it's also respectful care in between providers and services, right? So if we don't have that respect for each other's skill set and training, then we're not going to be able to take care of the patient well. And so respectful care goes to both sides. It goes to the patient and within your services so that we can take care of the patient together.
Absolutely. So tell me a little bit about this HOPE study. It's a national project. You're the lead investigator. What are kind of the aims of this particular study?
So I really feel like this podcast is very serendipitous because we just found out last Monday that the study is funded and we were elated. And in fact, after I get off the podcast tonight, I'm going to go celebrate with my other investigators. So the HOPE study, again, was really born out of a need. So when we're seeing these patients, as you know, Connie, it's really hard for us to counsel them because our American population is a very unique population. If you look at data out of Europe or out of Canada, they have lower obesity rates. They don't nearly have the disparities rates that we have. I mean, you know, Connie, in this country, our Black and brown birthing people are experiencing 3 to 4 times higher mortality rates. And then I don't even know how high the number is now for morbidity rates, but it's significantly higher than their white counterparts. And so I say that to bring attention to the fact that all the data that we have on heart disease and pregnancy comes from areas in the world where there's universal healthcare, where the disparities aren't nearly as bad, and where patients have that full coverage throughout pregnancy and into the postpartum period, well into their life course, which we don't have here in the United States. And so extrapolating data from countries where their healthcare is clearly better and the coverage is clearly better is not going to help our population. And so when I was counseling these patients in the cardiac unit, I started to think, well, does this really apply to this person in front of me when it was born out of data from an all-white population in Scandinavia, let's say? So there was really this need in this country to have our own population-based risk models so that we could counsel patients that have aortic stenosis or pulmonary hypertension. What is your risk of, one, having an adverse pregnancy outcome, so things like preeclampsia or bleeding? Two, what is your risk because of the pregnancy of having an adverse cardiac event, let's say arrhythmia or, God forbid, heart failure? And three, what is the risk of your baby having an adverse outcome like going to the NICU? And so this really came out of a need to counsel our own patients. And so what we've done is we've partnered with 35 centers across the country to recruit 1,000 birthing people that have known heart disease in pregnancy. And we picked the known because there's a lot of work going on right now in other studies, such as rebirth, for the unknown, such as peripartum cardiomyopathy. So we wanted to focus on those people who came into pregnancy with a known diagnosis of either an arrhythmogenic heart disease, acongenital, so they were born with it, an acquired, meaning they had a heart attack or a SCAD or spontaneous coronary artery dissection or some kind of valvular problem. And so we're going to recruit 1,000 women across the country and really just follow them over their pregnancy and life course for that year postpartum. And I think the uniqueness of this study, or the Heart Outcomes and Pregnancy Expectation Study, or HOPE, is that not only are we looking at clinical data, very rich, granular clinical data, so that we can build models to counsel our own patients, but we're also looking at what is causing this disparity, these disparities in this country. So we will be asking people about their experiences of discrimination within the healthcare system and in life, and seeing how that impacts their outcomes. We're also going to be asking them about their birthing experience and how that impacted their outcome. And I think what people forget about is that when you have some kind of event in pregnancy, or you have heart disease in pregnancy, and hopefully you do well, is that quality of life matters. I can tell you from my own experience having preeclampsia is that once I walked out of the hospital, that wasn't over for me. I had significant postpartum depression. I suffered from adverse events afterwards, and my quality of life was poor. And so when you have a poor quality of life, that needs to be recognized, because we can intervene on a social level to help people manage and cope and improve their outcomes so that they can properly take care of themselves and their babies.
I think you make some really good points. I know that there is a lot of work going on also in that interconception period. So tell me a little bit about have you been involved in any of that? You know, that's a special interest of mine, is how do we then not only address quality of life immediately postpartum, but how do we address quality of life long term?
No, I think that's an amazing point, is that we don't just forget about the mom once the baby's out, right? We have to take care of these people throughout their life course. And so I think you're referring to the fourth trimester, what people refer to as the fourth trimester, that transition from postpartum. And I really think it's 1 year after, because you really don't go back down to your normal physiologic state. And I would argue probably ever, but until at least a year postpartum. And so what we're focusing on in that time frame is twofold. One, that quality of life. So we're going to be asking them at 6 weeks postpartum, 6 months postpartum, and 1 year postpartum, what is your quality of life? We'll be using standardized and validated tools that get to the heart of what is going on with them, both socially, emotionally, financially, and how that's impacting their life and their outcome. But we're also going to be looking at clinical outcomes. So I think we both know that our postpartum show rate, meaning follow-up, is very poor in this country. And I think it's because, again, we forget as a country about the health of the woman after the baby comes out. And we really need to start focusing on that, because that is the time when people who have adverse pregnancy outcomes then develop lifelong complications such as renal disease or hypertension. And if they're not followed with their primary care physician or their OB provider or their cardiologist, so that we can risk modify them and bring their risk for adverse events such as heart attacks down, then we're not doing right by that family. And so that's exactly what we'll be doing, is following these people through that year postpartum, evaluating their clinical outcomes. We're not intervening by any means. I think that's going to be the next NIH grant, is looking at these outcomes and seeing how we can intervene. But we're also going to be asking them about their quality of life. So a lot of information gathering, because that's the problem with our country right now, is that other countries have the availability of very rich data that comes from databases. That costs money in this country. And so we're really trying to develop something along those lines so that everybody can tap into this data and information and utilize it, so we can then springboard it into interventions in the future.
I think that sounds amazing. Along those lines, as you know, as we've talked about, Black and brown women are more likely to have disparities in cardiac conditions, and they're often undiagnosed. Have you seen this in your population? And have you done any work to decrease this gap?
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, if somebody were to say that they haven't seen it, then they're not paying attention, is what I would say. So I live in Kansas City, but I practice mostly with rural patients in Missouri. And what I've been doing from just a local standpoint, so I'm the vice chair of patient safety and quality. And every time that I pull data to look at outcomes, I 100% disaggregate that data by race. And one of the PQCs that has done a phenomenal job at decreasing disparities is Ann Borders, as you know her, coming to speak with you all at the Tennessee or at the TIPQC. She's been able to decrease disparities when it comes to primary cesarean sections. And what I found was so impactful when she was discussing how she did this was that she actually showed people their data, right? Showed Dr. Smith and Dr. Taylor and Dr. Johnson, hey, your outcomes are X and they are different for brown women and white women. And I think that's not to say that we need to shame people. That is by no means the case. But if you don't know where you stand and you don't know how you compare to other providers, how are you supposed to improve? And so what I've been doing is really trying to bring that data to light, because we as providers get so busy. We're in the grind all the time. We're boots on the ground, taking care of patients. You don't think about that as much. What do my outcomes look like? And what does my data look like? And so really bringing that to light so providers can focus on that and make a difference. Because I don't think any provider out there wants to say, yeah, I treat Black women different than I treat white women. I just don't feel that people going to medicine have that intrinsic desire to do that. I think it's part of the system that we're in. Now, that's not to say that there absolutely is interpersonal discrimination and racism. But I think the bigger picture is the history of this country, the systemic racism that has bled into our healthcare system that has actually always been there and never gone away. I mean, we think about Tuskegee, we think about forced sterilization, we think about Black women and where some of our gynecologic equipment get named from, the Sims retractors, all these experimentations on Black birthing people's bodies. We need to really take that history, learn from it, and make a difference. And so that's what I'm trying to do at our own institution.
I really think that that's a great point. I always talk about structural racism. Where I deliver, where I live, what type of resources I have is often dictated by how I'm zoned, what's available to me in my area, even where I'm able to live. And so a lot of these things I think we see are a result of 400 years worth of policies that have not always been equal.
Absolutely. And you know, those are the things I think people feel are heavy and daunting for them as a provider. Like, well, I can't change the system. I can't change that history. But we can. We can do it at our own level, at our own institution, which then drives policy, right? So if I show at my own institution, we were able to decrease, let's just take an example, pain, right? We were able to decrease the differences in pain treatment for Black and Brown women, which we know is a problem in our system. We don't listen to Black and Brown women like we listen to white women. If we're able to decrease the disparities in that, then we can bring that to a policy level at our local and state legislatures. I think that there is this misconception that our legislatures are so big, quote unquote, that they don't listen to the small people. But I can tell you from my own personal experience, Connie, that's not actually true. So I'm just a little person, right? Like I work at a university. I don't have any connections to legislatures, but through working my connections with other people, so other providers and neighbors, getting a hold of legislatures and telling them about the problem of maternal mortality and morbidity in our state, we were able to convince our governor to allocate $5 million to maternal health in this fiscal year, which was incredible, right? On a second level, again, working through my colleagues that I know, was able to get to my congressman, the esteemed Emmanuel Cleaver, who is amazing and phenomenal, has represented Jackson County and Kansas City for a multitude of years. Met with him multiple times, did a maternal mortality roundtable. And you think behind the scenes that nothing is happening. I will tell you, I just got the amazing news that when we were trying to get funded for the HOPE Project, he actually wrote a letter to the HHS and the NIH on behalf of us saying that he needs his constituents funded. And I thought that was just phenomenal. We had talked to him years ago. He remembered that, and he advocated on our behalf, and really not on our behalf, but on the behalf of all women, particularly Black and Brown women, because there is a focus on HOPE looking at these disparities and trying to reduce those disparities and outcomes.
You know, I think that's really important. You know, I spent some time recently on the Hill just talking to representatives, letting them know what was available, those types of things, which often I think they just don't know. So, and we had a congressional briefing. We had a room full of people who wanted to hear about maternal mortality, hypertension, heart disease, and what we're doing.
Absolutely. And I think that you hit the nail on the head. They want to hear from their constituents, right? But I think what people, again, get overwhelmed by is, how do I get to that person? Well, you know that there is that game, 6 degrees of separation for Kevin Bacon, right? That also goes in medicine. Someone out there knows somebody who can help you. And so I would just say, start talking to people, asking if they know someone who works on these types of policies or works in your House local or Senate local legislatures, and really push that forward, because if they don't hear our voices, they're not going to know it's a problem. And so I'd encourage all providers, nurses, nurse practitioners, and doctors themselves, go out there and talk to your legislatures, because those are the people that are making the laws that are impacting our outcomes.
So we have only a few seconds left, and I want to talk to you a little bit about something that I recently was thinking about, and that's the use of AI in taking care of our patients and where you see us going with that.
You know, it's so funny that you say that, because my husband is also a general OB, and you guys should hear our table talk. It's really phenomenal. But one of the things we were talking about the other day is how imaging is really moving to AI. So one of the things that you and I, Connie, we do is do ultrasounds and interpretation of ultrasounds. And I think where it's going to impact us first is going to be the interpretation of images, both fetal images and things like CT scans and MRIs. I think that we will be seeing that first. What I also think we will be seeing is providers being able to use AI platforms, kind of like ChatGPT for the writer. I think that there will be the availability of AI to help us in diagnosis for those really difficult, critical diagnoses that are hard when you have a multitude of symptoms, and really narrowing down where you should focus your intervention.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm really excited. I was approached by an investigational team, and they're looking at EKGs and being able to predict women who have preeclampsia.
I think that's phenomenal.
You know, they've already done it in heart failure. So that's something we're going to be talking about and meeting up and looking at. But I just think that given some of the challenges we have with preeclampsia, hypertension, and heart disease, being able to incorporate all the portions of our toolkit is going to be really helpful in eliminating disparities. As I've said about the recent biomarkers, a number is non-biased.
Right. You can't argue with the data. So that's phenomenal.
Yes.
I'd love to hear about that when you get that going.
Yes, it's very interesting. And of course, you know, the biomarkers are out and we're doing some work with those. But again, all of these, I think, are tools that we're going to have in our toolkit to make the diagnosis of hypertensive disease and the diagnosis of cardiovascular disease much easier in the pregnant population.
Absolutely. And I'm really looking forward to that because that the cost of the healthcare system for preeclampsia is astronomical. And the cost of patients and their quality of life, as we were talking about, and their family's quality of life is truly burdensome. So to target that, I think, is a great start in obstetrics.
Well, like I said, we're finishing up, and I wanted to know if you had any last thoughts, anything you want to leave the audience with.
I'm just so grateful for you guys having me today. What I love about our region specifically, the Midwest South, is that we are locking arms and we're not recreating the wheel. And so working together, seeing what others do and implementing that is your own in your own state is so important. So I really want to thank you guys for having me today.
Well, we want to thank you for joining us here and recently at our TIPQC meeting. And we also appreciate all of your work and look forward to getting together as we care for moms and babies and try to, as you said, move the needle forward in our outcomes. So thank you so much for today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, presented by TIPQC. TIPQC is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health. Do you have ideas for a future guest or topic, or even have a question you would like answered on upcoming episodes? Visit www.tipqc.org, that's TIPQC.org, and click on podcast to submit suggestions and questions to our podcast team. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast to be the first to know when new episodes are available and find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to stay in the loop with our active projects and other relevant news relating to perinatal health in Tennessee.